Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Welcome back to Well That Aged Well, part two of our Julio-Claudian dynasty. I'm here again with Lindsay Powell, who has written Germanicus, and Marcus Agrippa, among many other books. And Jared, you've been working on one, I understand, as we talked about last time, a book on Tiberius. And we left last episode where we began speaking about the reign of Caligula. And of course, I want to begin with trying to go a little bit back and talk about his upbringing on Capri and how he lost his other family members, where his mother was exiled and eventually died, and what happened to his other brothers as well, because they really the only ones to survive were his sisters, whom we are going to talk about, of course, in when later on in his reign, which he became very close to, if not, or according to some rumors, very, very close to. So let's begin with Caligula coming to Capri and losing his family.
I think we have to sort of bring in the character here of Lucius Ilius Sejanus or Sejanus, because the arrival of the young Caius that is known by the nickname Caligula, he arrives on Capri pretty much after Sejanus is basically arrested and executed. And I think we talked about him in the last episode, but
yeah,
the fate of his family was really part of the manipulation, for what we can gather from Tacitus principally, by Sejanus. So if you recall, Sejanus seemed to have ambitions for going above where he was in Roman society. He'd been the trusted advisor, the gatekeeper of things in the administration that Tiberius had. He was basically his right-hand man in the same way that Marcus Agrippa was to Augustus. And in the same way that Augustus trusted Agrippa, Tiberius trusted Sejanus, if I use the English pronunciation. Sejanus probably is more correct in Latin. And for 15 years, it seems, from at least Tiberius's point of view, there was not much evidence of anything going wrong. But for the people back in Rome on the Palatine Hill, principally the family of the descendants of Germanicus, his sons, Drusus Nero, and for example, Caligula amongst them, and his sisters, things appear to have been pretty grim. And there was an affair, of course, between Sejanus and I think it was Livilla, was it? And that led ultimately to the murdering, and Tiberius didn't realize this until much later, the murdering of Drusus the Younger, who was also called Drusus Julius Caesar, just to confuse things. There were several of those in the family, but he was the natural son of Tiberius, and that was a big loss to him. And Tiberius never seemed to come over as being the cuddly guy and the family man, but the death of his son did affect him. And when he discovered later that in fact he had been murdered, I think that was a body blow to him, because he was prepared to accept that it might have been sickness or death by natural causes, but to find that it was an act of a crime was something else. And then finally, when all of this behind the scenes darkness, which he's been apparently oblivious to, we can discuss whether that was true or not, but the sources seem to create the impression that Tiberius was not aware, ensconced in his one of maybe 12 villas in Capri, that finally...
Well, was his son, by the way, was that his son from his first marriage or the second marriage?
The first marriage. So it was through Vipsania Agrippina. And he did, He had a child through Julia, who was the daughter of Augustus, but that child died, and that contributed partly, by the way, to the collapse of marriage. So when he, I believe, was in Aquincum on campaign in Illyricum, he received the news that, that the baby had died. And, you know, quite frankly, it seems to be that that broke them, amongst all the other things that he was learning or going to be learning about Julia at that point. So to then lose his only son was a loss, because in the grand scheme of things, if you remember the way it was queued up, back in the time that he had just started in 1814, Germanicus is very healthy, his son is alive, and, you know, there are several people in play. So Agrippa
Postumus... They don't upwards for that time there is at that moment, didn't they?
Yeah, but it looks like in AD 14, there are several people that could potentially be successors. Mm. And there's no suggestion at all that any of the children of Germanicus might be one of those people that later. Mm. But in the years that Sejanus begins to do his, I guess, dirty work, if that's what it was. And you have to remember, in the way that Tacitus writes his history, he always sort of starts with this idea of a man doing good, and then there's this decay. You know, so for example, in the case of Tiberius, he starts off as being the soldier, the actually quite noble, Senate-friendly Roman princeps, but then it all goes terribly wrong. And it goes terribly wrong partly because Germanicus dies, who's a good influence, and then Sejanus is the worm, if you will, that drives it into the core of it. And in the end, he becomes a despot and a tyrant. And interesting enough, when he does finally die, which of course is in 1837, so that's some years after Sejanus, because in fact, I think he dies in 26, I think. So in those intervening years, which is where your question was, that's where Caius is spending his time. So he's in his late teens at this point, going into his early 20s. So these are important years, impressionable years. But again, it points to the fact, what was really happening in Capri? And well, we talked about this last week. We sort of suggested various ideas, but quite frankly, we don't really know. The most benign case is that there was the friends of Tiberius, and they discussed poetry and plays and philosophy, and they looked into the sky every night and did astrology, maybe not so much astronomy. On the worst side of things, it was debauchery and cruelty and sadism. And I can't tell you really honestly which it was, because the sources are very biased, and they would tend to tell you it was on the debauchery side, and I kind of don't believe that, but I've not really got much evidence to be able to tell you otherwise. So if that's
what's the reason for this bias? Was this the Flavian propaganda at the time that they wanted to do?
Well, it certainly plays into the optics of the Flavian family, Vespasian, Titus, Domitian, as being much better than the previous family. And yet, oh, by the way, under Titus, he's actually minting coins, which, for example, have the image of Augustus and for example, Agrippa. And I think there might even be one or two with other people, like possibly Germanicus. So they go back into the fact, and they do pick people they think are worthy of commemoration and memorialization in that way.
Tiberius was not one of those.
I don't believe that is the case. That's right. And you know, the question is why? Well, again, you look back. I mean, so interesting enough. So Augustus is deified, Claudius is deified, Tiberius is not. But he also wanted it to be that way. He didn't want to be deified. I think he found it very irritating that he'd get deputations from places like the Spanish provinces saying, you know, we would love to be able to open a temple. And his answer was, no, not now, not ever. And what I think that tells you is something about the mindset of Tiberius, which is, you know, there is a pantheon of gods, and I'm not one of them. I'm an administrator. I am the servant of the people trying to get this thing going. Now, the divine Augustus, of course, that's a different thing. And so he goes into history as having this reputation of being a sort of tyrannical, on the cusp of evil in a way. And I'm in my research coming to the conclusion that's a very distorted picture. So to your point, it is, I think, in part down to painting the Flavian family in a good light. But the other thing, it's also the way that principally Tacitus writes his books. As I said, I mean, he sort of sets his people up to be, they have the promise of being good, but then there's the decay. There's the disappointment that goes with it. But the underwriting is, but that's inevitable because the system is based on the rule of an autocrat. And there are so few people who can be good autocrats. In the case of Augustus, Tacitus basically shrugs his shoulders and says, well, kind of, we had to have him because he kind of put things right and he was okay. Tiberius was okay to start, but didn't end that way. And along comes Caius. The trouble is with Tacitus, we actually miss all the books. So we don't actually know what he would have said. We missed that chunk. And you talked to Mr. Barrett about that, I'm sure, at great length. So what we're left to have is basically the book by Suetonius, which, of course, is full of gossip and rumor and little snippets of racy stories and other bits that that people know and love, of course. And there are other historians like Cassius Dio and Orosius and Eusebius and all the other sort of people who have bits and pieces that you can put together like a layer cake. But by the time that Caius comes on the scene, there's a lot of negative feelings, certainly in Rome. And I think this is the other thing to think about, is the historians, by and large, so we're talking Suetonius, we're talking Tacitus as our principal sources, are within Italy, are within Rome by and large. When you get to Cassius Dio, I mean, he's basically a guy in Asia Minor, as I recall, and he's 200 years later, so he's got a different perspective. But it begs the question, what did all the people outside of Italy think? And I've gathered a lot of evidence in the case of, for example, Tiberius, where you just look at local coinages throughout Asia Minor and through Greece and through the provinces out there, and they are very, very eager to associate themselves with Tiberius. And Drusus, by the way, his son. There are a lot of things that are happening that celebrate the good health and the well-being of Tiberius. So from their perspective, because he's trying to enforce good administration, in the case of earthquakes, he goes out and brings cash and help. He helps to rebuild things. Even in the center of Rome, which has a fire, right, he actually comes in and sort of says, anybody that's financially injured by this, I will help with compensation. And that's in an age when there's no insurance. So he becomes like the insurance lender, if you will, or the backstop for that. And it's a very bold and paternalistic thing. So in a sense, in that way, Tiberius is acting as a patron and his people are the clients. So in that way, he's a very good figure. And it just seems to be by the end of his reign, and he's off in Capri, and people are imagining all sorts of things, when finally along comes this young 25-year-old who happens to be the direct descendant of Germanicus Caesar, there are great hopes. I mean, this man brings vigor and youth and the happy memory of his father. And he arrives in Rome with great celebrations and so on, and people expect great things.
So let's talk about something. And he does at an early first 7 months before he falls ill, and he does genuinely do a job, and he says he's going to abolish the Tiberius treason trials, and he does it at least in the beginning, and he does seem to try to get the Senate on his side, and he does seem to be genuinely a decent emperor at least the first half year of his reign.
That does seem to be that what we get from what we're told. And part of the challenge that we have, it's a bit like JFK. I mean, I often refer to the death of Germanicus as the JFK moment, but I'm going to stretch this a little bit if you'll indulge me, is that John F. Kennedy didn't exist as president of the United States long enough for bad things to happen. Obviously, in fact, he was assassinated. But what I mean is that he had an agenda, and he wasn't present long enough for us to know whether he would have succeeded or not. It was for his successor, LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, whose library here is in Austin, by the way, in Texas, to actually do all of those things. So, in fact, the glow of this young, attractive leader was never tarnished enough. And it was the hard work of his successor that had to pick up the pieces. And there's an interesting parallel, isn't there, that in the sense that Tiberius had reigned, what, for, let me look at it, 23 years. He was 77 when he died. And along comes a 25-year-old Caligula, but he'll only reign for 4 years. So we don't know how really bad he could have got. But the thing is, it's also very short a length of time for us to know whether what that was that he did that was good was enduring. And again, I come to this issue that since most of the writers of the time are really this elite class focused on Rome, what was the feeling outside in the greater empire? And what's fascinating about Caligula is that he did travel a little bit. He did go to the German provinces, and he did revisit, he had a certain vendetta that he wanted to settle. The story being that he was very acutely aware of the nickname that they had given him. The Rhine legions had given him the name Caligula, and he didn't like that too much. He was Caius. He was born Caius, and that there's a scene in, I think it's Suetonius, where effectively he sets out to decimate the legions as a punishment all those years later. For the humiliation, and then he goes on this slightly wacky invasion of Germany, which actually isn't invasion at all. It all seems to be slightly crazy, but again, you've got to remember who's actually telling the story. And yet, what's fascinating is that as you look at the archaeology and you look more deeply into the story, he replaces the governor of Germany at that point with somebody else. And it seems to be he's making really interesting preparations for an invasion of Britain, which, of course, is still outside the Roman Empire at this point, and around 39 going into 40, that there's a mobilization of the troops, and they sort of start doing that work with building forts and so forth. And then there's that curious situation when the troops march onto the beaches of Northern Gaul, yeah, are told, pick up shells and all this sort of stuff. But what they leave, interestingly enough, what they leave is a tower, which is a pharos. And I just wonder, in fact, the point was, actually, he was there to build a pharos as part of the campaign. And maybe this was, hey, guys, pick up some shells and take them back to your wives and girlfriends. Actually, they wouldn't have had wives, they were in the army. But, to the people you hold dear, and he gives them money and so on and so forth. So, again, a little bit like the way that the rumors of insanity would come later. I mean, people refer to his horse as Incitatus, as the consul. And as Mary Bid will tell people who watch her documentaries, that may well be more in the lines of, you're also dim, I could put my horse as a consul, and that would be better. And that then, because, oh, he's made his horse the consul, which maybe he didn't actually do. And in the same way, his troops go to Gaul, they build this pharos, and the intention is maybe to go back there and actually do the conquest, but he doesn't live long enough for the conquest to actually take place. But the military
and what to interrupt you as well, yeah, sorry for doing that, but and what to mention the shell story you mentioned, because we do speak, and we're not going to talk too much about Caligula in this episode, but because I want to mention that we did early on, it's almost 3 years now, I think, 3 years wow, ago, we did an episode, yeah, with Caligula, with Anthony Barrett about Caligula.
Yeah.
And we spoke about the shell episode, but it could also signify that it was kind of a victory, that they did go there, and they did, I'm not exactly sure is how the quote they talked about, but it signified kind of sort of victory that he had, looked at me, I went there, we would kind of a trophy in a sense, to put it, for lack of better words, that he actually didn't went. That's what the shells would signify.
Yeah, it's a great story, isn't it? I mean, here's the most powerful man in the Western world, and what does he do? He goes and gets his army, which is the most professional army in the world as well, and they pick up shells, and then they parade them in Rome as part of this triumph which he demands. Having said people, oh, by the way, I'll cut your head off if you actually offer me a triumph, but Caesar. So they actually have other people stand-ins for prisoners. The whole thing is a completely triumphed, a pantomime of a thing. I'm just reading here, for example, Tacitus in Agricola 13.4, that Caius Caesar, Caligula, meditated an invasion of Britain is perfectly clear, but his purpose is rapidly formed were easily changed, and his vast attempts on Germany had failed. So I think if you took that literally, that there was an intention to invade Britain. And you've got to remember that he's the grandson of Drusus the Elder. He is the son of Germanicus, and he doesn't have any military victories. And what his family, being Claudian, I mean, he's Julio-Claudian, but there's kind of Claudian blood going through this, is the tradition of having military victory to improve your standing. And that's something, when we talked about Claudius, will also be the case. And he goes to his death without really having any military victories at all. So all these other things are just basically optics to make up the fact that they weren't real.
So let's talk about it, because I'm referring to the episode that we did on Anthony Barrett. And of course, there is a documentary by Tony Robinson, I think, the guy from Blackadder. And he did an episode about Caligula as well. And I think Anthony Barrett, again, is future. And he spoke about that. He was genuinely loved by the people, though, not mm-hmm. much by the Senate.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and it's easy for us to forget that, isn't it? I mean, that people who are away from the center of politics can be immensely popular, whereas in the center of that political power, there's a different perception. There's the sense of overbearing power, of sort of no focus, of personal ambitions which go beyond those of the country. And, you know, I mean, you know, but I live in a country, the United States, where some of those sorts of things are, you know, creaking and are on display. But if you ask the ordinary people in the country, I mean, they have their heroes and they have different views of those people. And the people who write the newspapers with opinion columns today, because they're close to when they can interview those people, have a different perception of those people drinking coffee at Starbucks or other places around the United States.
So let's talk about some of the things why he was loved by the people. And then do have the story that he wanted to go run across the water with his horse. So he made this gigantic bridge with the boats where he ran his horse over, which cost extremely amount of money. And this was just one of the many sort of stories that he did.
Well, that comes straight out of Suetonius Caius 19.3, and I can read you a bit of the extract because I've got it down here.
Yeah.
I know that many have supposed that Caius devised this kind of bridge in rivalry to Xerxes. And you remember Xerxes is the king of Persia, a part of ancient Greece time, who excited no little admiration by bridging the much narrower Hellespont. Others, that is, to inspire fear in Germany and Britain, on which he had designs, by the fame of some stupendous work. But when I was a boy, I used to hear that my grandfather, and this is Suetonius talking about him as a young boy hearing these stories. So that tells you in the 50s and 60s AD, he's a little boy and he's hearing these stories, which is why I think it's very interesting. But when I was a boy, I used to hear my grandfather say that the reason for the work, as revealed by the emperor's confidential courtiers, was that Thrasyllus, the astrologer, had declared to Tiberius, when he was worried about his successor and inclined towards his natural grandson, that Caius had no more chance of becoming emperor than of riding about over the Gulf of Baiae with horses. So he builds the bridge to fulfill the prophecy, is the implication of that. So again, it's a great story. Did it happen? It sounds like it actually did. I mean, the fact is, Suetonius' grandfather is telling him the story, so it sounds like it was real. And I mean, you must have seen how big the Gulf of Baiae is. It's the Gulf of Naples, pretty big, that. But of course, it depends on where they build the bridge, right? They might have just taken two narrowest points and built it. But the optics were great. And here's Caius, the new king of Persia, if you will.
But it seemed to be genuinely loved by the people what he did because it was a public spectacle and people came to see this, the emperor crossing the water like this, because I don't think anyone done this before. And people, it seems genuine that they're loved by the people for doing this.
Yeah, and in the city, you're going to be having, you know, circus games and gladiatorial games in the forum and all that sort of stuff. And I mean, this is a 25, 26, 27-year-old, right? Enjoying life, I'm going to guess. I mean, he's enjoying the adulation. He's having the party and so on and so forth. And he has a lot of money. And oh, goodness, does he spend money? So, in fact, when he actually inherits the role, Tiberius leaves him an enormous treasury. The thing was, Tiberius was kind of mean. Right. He didn't spend
He was kind of a bit of a Scrooge, weren't he?
He was absolutely a Scrooge, but he would look at it this way. My job is fiscal responsibility. I'm not going to be putting on plays. I'm not putting on gladiatorial games. And oh, by the way, those were things which actually contributed to his unpopularity, right? And nobody was then going to go do those things because that's not what people did by that time. I mean, the local provincial cities, you know, a local rich businessman or notable could throw on games, and certainly they did that in places like Capua and elsewhere. But Rome really lacks an amphitheater at this point, right? I think wooden structures that are temporary. They put in the forum. There are several theaters for putting on plays, but they're not best for gladiatorial combats. And along comes this Cass Caligula, who will put them on, right? So the contrasts. People love this stuff, and you can understand why that would really make him a popular figure.
Of course, we have to remember that Colosseum weren't there at this point. It was built
That's
in
right.
69 AD, nice. But still, it's they did have mini, like you said, they had wooden Colosseum, but there wasn't the Colosseum we know today.
Rome at this point is basically a city of tenement buildings. Most of them are not very well built. We were discussing before we came on air about Crassus and how he would actually make an awful lot of money out of buildings, either because they were burning or his guys would deliberately set them on fire so that he could either offer you a firefighting service for cash or wait till the building was collapsed and he'd just buy it off the cheap. But that was how things were. I mean, the city to an outsider would appear to be pretty shoddy, I think. Buildings were high, but kind of almost medieval in their sort of, you know, wattle daub timber construction. Some were built of brick, but not that many. So that you can imagine that when Augustus makes the boast, I find the city of brick and I left it one of marble, well, that probably wasn't very hard to do because most of the buildings are made of brick and he can build a few in marble and people go, whoa, he's built a forum. He's built at the Roman Forum and all the rest of it. And it hasn't changed much. That's what's interesting about it. By the time Augustus dies, the most that Tiberius builds, as I recall, I think is he rebuilds the temple to the Dioscuri brothers, Castor and Pollux, which he actually names for his brother. You know, that's an act of devotion for him. And a couple of other buildings, in contrast to Augustus, who built a lot of buildings and renovated temples. And along comes Caius with promises of new buildings. But again, like I said earlier, he's only there for 4 years, so there's not a great deal to go by. But what we start seeing is some of the slightly crazy stuff that he does build. He wanted to build a sort of suspended corridor between the Palatine Hill, where his villa was. And his villa basically was adjacent, as I understand it, adjacent to where the Villa Tiberiana is now. And it would go, the structure would go across over to the Capitol Hill. And the idea being something, well, I can walk to go and talk to the gods because that's kind of, you know, over there. They're very, very close. So these things would have been seen by people as being really odd and quite amazing engineering achievements to be able to build things that high up. But they certainly could do that with their technology. But again, 4 years, he can't build much. But in the meantime, he can offer largesse. Great parties, do these wacky, let's build a bridge across the bay, and more to come, or promises thereof.
And I want to talk about his marriage for a second, because he was not the best, he's one of the husband of the year, you might say, because they do have a famous quote where he says, he goes behind his wife, I don't remember his name, her name, sorry, but he does go behind her wife's. His wife, and he says, "Off with a hand, if the emperor so wishes."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but again, you know, so we have the sources that we have. We don't know the truth of the behind closed doors conversations, because ultimately, well, where, who said what to whom, and who wrote it down, and was it accurate in the recording, all the rest of it. I recall, wasn't his last wife, was it Cezonia, I think?
I'm not sure, to be honest.
My understanding is that he was alleged to have had all sorts of sexual flings of different kinds with his sisters. Whether true or not, I don't know. But I mean, again, it's scandalous, the whole idea. I mean, it's an incestuous.
I'd rather bring this up because there is some meme, I don't know if you've seen it, where there is ultra legal. Oh no, I discovered my sister's OnlyFans. Hey, not bad.
Yeah, he clearly was very fond of his sisters, you know, and whether that turned into a sexual fondness, again, I think in some respects we sort of have to rely completely on our sources, and they may have invented them, because again, what they're trying to do is
made up. It does, to me, kind of sounds like flagrant propaganda.
Well, it's hard to say. And again, let's think about this for a second. The principal source that we have for the life of Caius Caligula is Suetonius, his book, The Life of Caius. And it starts with a little precede story of Germanicus, his father. And the reason he does that is really to say, here is the role model, and here's my subject, and look how adrift of the role model my subject is. And he does the same thing with Claudius. We'll talk about that later. And it's a technique that he uses where he contrasts good, bad, you know, wickedness and goodness and these sorts of things. And Germanicus Caesar seemed to be loyal to his wife, Agrippina the Elder, had, I think, like 11 or 9 children, at least by her. So, you know, even though they were a young couple, I mean, they were in the business of making families, and they were very fond of each other. And, you know, to that degree, you could argue that Caius had a good upbringing. I mean, there was the incident, of course, we talked a little bit about in Germany, where there's a mutiny in AD 14. Germanicus has to put that right. And it's the appeal to the troops that we're actually moving my family to a safer place because this army camp isn't safe enough. So say goodbye to little Caligula. He's going there with my wife. Goodbye. And of course, the soldiers at this point are bereft because they say, you're taking our mascot away. No, no, no. And this supposedly breaks the mutiny. And that's another great story. But like I said earlier, I mean, he seems to remember that, the fact that they were there to do that. And he goes back several years later, 39, to basically make those people pay, the ones that were still alive at the time. But the antics that he got into, I think in the end, he finds a woman that sort of understands him. And I believe it's Cezonia. And she's a different kind. I don't know that there's any accounts of her physical looks and those sorts of things. But in a world of topsy-turvy life, she seems to be the stable one that he can go to. And, you know, there are all sorts of parallels in life. And it just occurred to me, for example, Henry VIII and his 6 wives. I mean, one of the people that he genuinely loved was the last wife, who seemed to have got to understand what he was as a man, what he needed, but it kind of, for him, it's too late. And in the same way, it's too late for Caligula as well with his last wife. And they had a child as well.
So it's worth knowing about why that he was liked by the people and that he was genuine and seemed to be outside of the center. But let's talk about some of the things that made him disliked by the elite and those closest to Caligula, and what made him so. It's part about the horse story of my horse to be a better senator than you. But let's talk about why he was disliked as a senator.
Well, I think in a nutshell, it comes down to there's still a resentment of the idea of this now hereditary autocracy. It's not really a monarchy. It's certainly not elected. It's just sort of, well, Tiberius is replaced by this other guy, and along comes Macro as his head of the Praetorian cohorts to enforce that. I mean, there's no discussion. It's just basically, hooray, you know, Caius is our new princeps, and let's change the coins and all that sort of thing. And as you pointed out, there seems to be a good interface and open dialogue between the principal institutions of government, which are in this case mostly the Senate. But over time, that begins to degrade. And I would imagine that people are looking at the state of finances and some of this erratic behavior, and thinking this is not what we look for in a Roman head of state. So these must have been increasingly of concern, and these failed expeditions to Germany and then to Britain, and then this sort of rather bizarre triumph that we talked about a few moments ago, all really would get thinking people to question, really, is this right? And then there are these gratuitous examples of cruelty, both to members of his own family, but just people around him, you know. And does this mean that he's mad? I was looking at some of the materials. What they described as madness doesn't necessarily mean mad in the sense that we now call it, like, as a mental condition. It was just the astonishing variety of his erratic behaviors, which seems to then go back to the point at which he was sick at some point, and he apparently emerges believing that he's a god, Jove, and bizarrely is the way that the Senate seems to go along with it. If you remember from I, Claudius, I mean, with John Hurt playing Caligula marvelously, they just kind of go along with it. On the other hand, there's this wonderful scene where one of the senators said, basically, we're so glad that you've recovered, Caesar. And he's heard this rumor, that the Caligula's heard this rumor, that the senator had promised to offer his life if Caligula would be spared and would come, you know, would recover. And basically says, so why are you still here? You know, take a dagger on me. And these sorts of and I don't know whether that's actually in Suetonius, but it's the sort of thing you can imagine that will be circulated. So that sort of thing would contribute to a general sense of ill ease, dis-ease, and a need for changes. But it really comes to a head with Cassius Chaerea, finally, to try and lead a plot to oust him, and that is the thing that finally does him in. It's actually it's a military coup, effectively.
Before we go into his death, I want to talk about his uncle as well, Claudius, when we are going to talk more about him. How does he come? Because he does enter Caligula's life as well. I do believe he is by his side when he fell ill, and he does have a decent role in Senate, I guess, but he seem to have a role in Caligula's life as well.
I think so. Just to give everybody the family tree. So Claudius is the son of Drusus the Elder and Antonia. He's the brother of Germanicus. So when Germanicus dies, you know, he becomes important because he's the survivor of the immediate family. Claudius is generally maligned in the sources because he's lame. He has a stammer. People ascribe to him mental deficiency. I think people were going to be surprised actually how really quite a bright man he was. But the point is, they keep him out of view mostly. And that's a deliberate thing, partly because when he's around at the time of Augustus, Augustus has this kind of fear of dwarfs and misshapen people and things of that nature. He's kind of really almost freaked out by that, and he's got one in Claudius who's a bit too close to home. But as all these other things are happening around him over the decades, Claudius seems to find a place to survive, and he buries his time in writing histories. And he famously writes a book of Etruscan history and Carthaginian history. Apparently he had learned Etruscan.
Which is sad and lost, and I will still weep.
Yes, and by all accounts, he was writing a book about his own family, I think principally to memorialize his father, Drusus the Elder, of whom he was very, very, very respectful and fond of, and would go on to commemorate later. We'll talk about that as our conversation unfolds. But you have the impression of this man who his own family doesn't like, who is embarrassed by, and nevertheless is a family man who spends much of his time in the palace. So he's around a lot. And Caligula is a young person and no doubt would have spent time, you know, playing games or whatever with his sisters, but there's the figure of Uncle Claudius in the background. Actually, we call him Claudius, by the way, because he probably would have been called Uncle Tiberius because his name was Tiberius Claudius Nero. And they probably called him by his first name, not because they were all basically either Julie or Cloudy. So they wouldn't actually sort of talk about Uncle Julius because that was something different. But you see how I'm going with it.
So, of course, we have to talk about, we do have to move on, sadly. I wish to speak more about Caligula, but if you do want to learn more about him, you are more than welcome to check out. It's episode 30, so it's quite early on in the podcast, or just scroll down if you're on YouTube. And but I did interview Anthony Barrett a few years ago, not many, but still, about Caligula. So if you want to learn more about him, you should definitely check out that episode. So let's go to the death of Caligula and what the assassin plot to murder him.
I was going to say, by the way, as a tribute to you, that the fact that you can actually talk to him and other eminent scholars, I mean, it's a testament that you know your history, and they respect you as an interviewer. So well done.
I
So the
appreciate
death,
that.
yeah. So well, great. So there seems to be a conspiracy that breaks out. And as I recall, the story as related is that there's one officer, particularly Cassius Chaerea, who of conservative politics and mind sees what's going on and doesn't like it at all. And so Caligula would give the watchword every day to his officers, so that that would be what they'd use to recognize friend from foe. And he'd give them names, for example, like "Kiss Me Quick" sort of thing, and it was all designed in jest, it seems, but Cassius Chaerea never got the joke, or actually got very tired of them. So he hatches a plot, and effectively, the plot involves creating a diversion so that when Caligula is attending games or a theatre performance, he's invited to come away and go down a particular corridor where he will be assassinated. And fascinatingly, archaeologists believe they have found that corridor. It's a brick corridor around the Palatine Hill, and he was basically butchered. It very unpleasant. It was basically a few armed troops stabbing him and causing quite a degree of butchery. But the deed is done. And Cassius Chaerea then basically is effectively looking to the Senate at that point to restore the older style Res Publica, the Republican
And
style of government
again, we come
police.
back to this where they want to reestablish a Res Publica. This is seems to be a common occurrence. Let's report about
Yes.
in the death of Tiberius. They wanted to remake the
Well,
Res Publica. And what is dead? They don't understand that what is dead. They don't can't bring it. It's pretty much.
we talked about it, didn't we, the last time when we were talking about Marcus Junius Brutus and Cassius Longinus too. And what I said there was, okay, they hatched a conspiracy, and they were successful in the first objective, which was to take down the tyrant or the person they thought was the tyrant. They didn't have a plan for the after assassination. And in this particular case, they lose control of what happens. So Caligula has a German bodyguard like Augustus had had, and Tiberius, I believe, too. The Custodes Corporis Germania, I believe. And I think these were either people who are Batavians or from the Ubi. Point is, anyway, they were to everybody else a terrifying crew, because they were this first rank of bodyguards, and they discover what's happened to the man. Oh, by the way, who pays their pay? Who pays them their money? And all hell breaks loose. So they're running around trying to find who's responsible for the assassination of their man. And in the meantime, Cassius Chaerea is presumably trying to rally people to calm the whole situation. And the story goes that in all this panic is that Claudius, who at this point, by the way, is now, let me look on the fit, he's now 51. So you've got a 51-year-old who apparently secretes himself away in one of the rooms behind a curtain in one of the rooms, and is discovered by the Praetorian cohorts. And in this particular case, then they decide that he is going to be their princeps. And it's important because the whole point of the Praetorian cohorts is to guard the body of the princeps, the emperor. So if they have a republic, there will be no one to to actually defend, and therefore they'll be basically out of a job. So you end up with this rather slightly perverse situation that they're in it for the money, you could say, and they give the Senate basically an ultimatum. So they take Claudius to their Praetorian camp, which, interestingly enough, Sejanus had arranged to build in Rome under the reign of Tiberius, because at that point they were billeted across not only the city of Rome, but across Italy. And in fact, he brought them together and they cohabited the place with the Vigiles, who were the fire service and the one that basically offered a sort of a night watch. And the ultimatum is basically, well, we've got the man and you can accept him. We've got the pointy things to enforce our particular position. So the Senate has a discussion and effectively kowtows to the Praetorian cohorts. And before they know it, they've got princeps number three. Number four, because it was Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, and now it's Claudius. It's fourth. So going back to Cassius' career, this was not the plan at all. So they replaced one autocrat they didn't like with another autocrat that they didn't like much more. But the Senate, I think, because they got to know Claudius as being foolish, they thought maybe they can get their way with him. And weren't they in for a surprise?
I want to talk about Claudius a little bit, because, of course, we're going to talk about the invasion of Britain in a bit. But I feel like it's really underrated that he actually was quite a good emperor. He didn't only reign for 13 years-ish. But still, he should be up there with one of the good emperors, I think, because he was genuinely a good emperor. And I feel like he's reliable, because he wasn't very popular and he wasn't kind of the guy you think would end up. He was the underdog in a sense, I feel like, and still ended up on the top. So to me, at least, he is kind of a reliable person.
Well, so a lot of what you say is true. At least that's my reading of it too. But on the positive side, so he's 51, right? So we've gone from basically being the 70-year-old Tiberius to a 25-year-old Caligula now to someone halfway between those, right? Mm. So, someone who's got a bit of vigor, a bit of life, but crucially is the brother of Germanicus, is the son of Drusus the Elder. So he's got two big names behind him. He is somebody that people know to be sort of this historian, slightly fuddy-duddy, presumably, but he's not really actually done anything wrong in his life that anybody would bring and point out he's wicked because of this. I think he was a bit of an unknown quantity. So when he takes over, he has this very uneasy thing to have to do. He's got the Praetorian cohorts, basically, who put him there. One of the first things he does, he pays them a donative. And that becomes something he does every year, interesting enough. It's like he has to guarantee he's going to stay there. And they say, it's the anniversary, our hands are out for the cash. But he's also aware, because he's been able to observe what's going on in Rome all of these years, the sort of corruption that goes on in the corn trade, and some of the sort of things where the common people are not best served by things like infrastructure. So he embarks on things like projects to rebuild Ostia, to really sort of build infrastructure like aqueducts, and to provide stuff that's going to really work for the betterment of society. So that you get the impression from this that he's read his history books, he's seen what was working in the partnership between Augustus and Agrippa, and a lot of what they had done was public infrastructure and so on, and they were very successful in doing that. It was very popular. And at the same time, there's the administrative stuff that he's dealing with. He's a guy, and I wrote an article very recently for Ancient History, Ancient Warfare magazine, where I was trying to explain there that he embarked on a series of what we call now reforms, kind of really refinements. He's had enough time to look at things and take advice from people. So he was able to look again at things like terms, conditions of service, things that didn't work very well that maybe needed some tweaking. And there were some issues that, for example, Roman troops were not allowed to marry. Well, that's okay. But the trouble is, if they actually have a Roman citizen's son, that son wouldn't be recognized, which meant if anything had happened to the soldier, their inheritance wouldn't pass to their son, which was really quite a bad oversight. So he changed the rule. So he enabled those people to be able to do that. And that was a popular thing. For people in the auxiliary troops, which were non-Roman professional troops, he instituted and formalized the process of issuing the, what we now call diplomas, which meant that people had literally proof in bronze of their rights as Roman citizens, and that was something that extended also to the Roman fleets. He embarked on some interesting campaigns to sort out some difficulties in places like Mauritania. We'll talk about Britain in a second. Some of these were wars of necessity. There were troubles that he tried to fix. And again, he knew that these were the things that you'd have to do as an emperor, as a princeps. There was the possibility of a war opening up with Parthia, but he knew from his history that was not a smart thing to do, so they backed off on that. So when you look at this totality of him, in the way he does things, he's a reliable man at the right moment, because up to that point, the situation seemed to be chaotic. The state had run out of money. Caligula had spent it all. So between Tiberius and the arrival of Claudius, he has to fix the deficit. So he's got to tinker with the tax system to start to bring in money into the coffers. And this is also, by the way, the reason why you have to have a conquest, because you need to go bring the gold and the jewels from those places and be able to sell them and realize them to pay for all the other things that he wants to do. And it's quite a remarkable reign in that respect.
So I want to, before we go into the battle, the conquest of Britain, I want to talk about his wife, because she's quite, you might say, a piece of work. And that is, of course, Agrippina the Younger, who also has some ambition for her son, a certain Nero.
Well, can we talk about Messalina first?
Yeah,
so before her, there was Messalina. And actually, before her, there was another lady called Ugolania, who was an arranged marriage, and apparently it was very awkward. And if you remember from I, Claudius, that the actress who played that role was much taller than Claudius himself, played by Derek Jacobi. And of course, it's the scene where they mock him because they keep saying she kept on growing and growing, you know. And of course, it's all very embarrassing. But Messalina is a person who arrives in his life. That he seems to form a really, really deep love for. What he doesn't realize is that she's playing him. And she is, shall we put it this way, she has a high libido, and that there are stories where basically she attracts another lover, and in one contest, she competes with a prostitute for who can have the most lovers in the night, and apparently she wins. This is all happening in the forum. What is also happening at the same time, part of the government system that Augustus has set up, but really developed and was fine-tuned under Claudius, was the role of freedmen. So a freedman is a former slave. And in the particular case of Claudius, he has two, Pallas and Narcissus. And basically, one is the one that looks after his administration from the point of view of records and that sort of thing. And the other one basically is rather more to do with policy decisions. And they're fully aware what Messalina's doing. And it's really down to those guys to save Claudius from himself. And in discovering what she's up to, they try very hard to work out how they're going to get this woman out of the system. And finally, they arrange for her to be arrested by having him sign basically her arrest warrant and her execution. And he doesn't realize this because he's blind drunk when he does this. And finally, when he wakes up, calls for his wife, and he's told, she was executed last night on your orders. And you know. So he's quite bereft by that. But so there's a suggestion somehow that he becomes quite cynical, you could argue, that with the loss of someone that he loved, who betrayed him, that did he really care anymore? And interesting enough, of course, Agrippina is his niece. So you have this really interesting situation where they're related by blood, and she has a young son, Domitius Hanabarbus, by her husband, and he agrees to marry her, which then brings the son into play as a natural successor. And
I want to stop you for a second again.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, because I want to ask, as you know, in medieval Europe and up to early modern times, the purity in, you mentioned that they were related, and this, I want to know, Because, you know, especially in the Habsburg lines and the other royal lineages, purity of the blood and that intermarriages were kind of the hot thing. And then spoke about this with the Ptolemies as well, intermarriage was kind of a thing. Was in the Roman world, was purity as well a thing that kind of where, you know, that it's a royal family, then purity is, what was that not important?
I don't know so much in the case of the Julia Claudia, that the family of Augustus in its broader sense. I'm not sure that Romans necessarily understood the genetic risks of intermarrying people close to you in the way that it caused problems for the Egyptian families, for example. Akhenaten famously, I think, married a sister or something, and that caused all sorts of problems. But I think in this particular instance, and it's not particularly clear why he did it, because he already had his own son, who was nicknamed Britannicus after the conquest of Britain. He actually, so his son was called the Briton, if you will, or the Victor of Britain. But the issue there is that we can only surmise from looking at the text, and now we can go back to Tacitus as well as Suetonius and Cassius Dio, is that she was a very strong woman who had ideas about how the state should be run. And the fact that she was a woman and she wasn't supposed to be involved in politics didn't seem to be a problem for her. You've got to remember where she came from. And she's a descendant, of course, of Marcus Agrippa through that line. You have to remember what her mother was like, right? So she was a strong woman. She'd actually been exiled for part of her life, and she came back from that and was rehabilitated. So I see in Agrippina this very resourceful, strong woman who had ambitions for herself, but also through her son. And this would this effect if she was setting her own dynasty. And in Claudius found someone who happened to be the princeps, who would go along with it. And this is what he does. He marries her, and he basically nominates her son to be the next in line of succession, and his name is changed from Domitius Henobarbus to Tiberius Claudius Nero Drusus Germanicus and all the rest of it, known as Nero, which is interesting because Nero is a classically Claudian name. So Nero was the name of his father, Nero Claudius Drusus, and it went all the way through the Claudian line. It was a Sabine word, Sabines being a tribe in Italy going several centuries back. When the Romans were competing for land, and they were the Latins at that time, which means basically strong, and it's a name that carries with it very positive associations. So along comes this young man with this new name Nero, who's basically rebranded in the Julio-Claudian family, with a mother who's got big ambitions. I'm not aware that there were any children between Claudius and his new wife. She probably didn't want any anyway, because she already had the one that she had ambitions for.
So we mentioned, we teased a little bit about conquest and then Bethlehem correcting the conquest of Britain. And as we talked about before, many have tried with Caesar and the conquest and failed. And of course, Caligula tried and failed. So what made the conquest of Britain so successful for Claudius, and why did it first now succeed in the conquest of Britain? And let's go into why it chose. You spoke about treachery. Was that part of why he chose to try again, at least a third time, to conquer the British Isles?
I preface it by saying this. So you remember when I talked about Caligula having no military experience, and dressed up his activities in Germany, but on the shores of Gaul, as military conquests? Well, the same problem affected Claudius, right? Now you've got to remember what family he came from. He came from a family of successful warrior leaders, going all the way back to Claudius Marcellus, who famously fought with a Gallic chieftain and seized his armor once he'd killed him and achieved what was called the spolia opima, which was this basically blood-drenched war a panoply. And then you would actually take it to the temple of Jupiter Feretrius. And there were only three people ever did that. One was actually Romulus, so he was the second. So this is in the family tree the greater family tree of Claudius. So his father is the famous conqueror of Germany. That's how he got his cognomen Germanicus, which is how his son got his first name. So when Drusus the Elder, or Drusus Maior, if you will, brother of Tiberius, in his young career, he achieved a number of things. He, first of all, was very successful in the Alps. He fought an Alpine war in 15 BC, where he famously defeated the Riti, who were a confederation of Iron Age Celtic tribes that were spread across the central Alps and the southern slopes of the Alps on the northern side in what's called the Voralpenland. And they were a problem for the Romans. The Romans at that time didn't actually occupy or control most of northern Italy. So what Drusus was able to do was kind of bring that under Roman control. And he did that in a campaign with his brother Tiberius. And then later, he was involved in a four-year campaign across the Rhine. So he was very successful in pushing Roman control, first along to the Ems and the Lippe, and ultimately ending at the Elbe. I think we may have talked about the last time. So Claudius, as the son of Drusus the Elder, can look to this man and say, I'm his son. What's very interesting, within a couple of years of him becoming emperor, we've got to remember that he's on the throne from 41 AD, right? Within about 1 year, 2 years, is thinking about what is he going to do to actually achieve this military victory. And he issues coins. And the coins have the head on the one side of Drusus, Nero Claudius Drusus. On the other hand, they have emblems of war in Germany. And with his name on, and the association is, my name is Emperor Claudius, and my dad is the conqueror of Germany. Aren't I, you know, a lucky guy? And what he then tries to do is assume the mantle of his father. Now, Caligula had tried in Germany and failed. His brother Germanicus had tried in Germany and arguably had failed. And Tiberius at that point told him, don't go there anymore. So the only place left was Britain. And you could argue, as we were talking earlier, that in fact Caligula had designs on conquering Britain and started building the military infrastructure along the Rhine River. So the plans for conquest, and again, supposition on my part, is that you have to imagine that there were invasion plans which the individual legionary commanders or the propraetorian legate responsible for Gallia Belgica, for example, would have. He probably would have had a master plan as to how they're going to do this, which units, supply chains, you know, boats being built and all the rest of it. So arguably, Claudius already had a ready-made plan. All he had to do was press the green button, go, invade. So what it seems to be is that the conquest of Britain fulfilled a number of very useful things for him. It established him in the long line of the Claudii, most notably his own dad and his brother. And in the other respect, is if he was actually successful, it showed that he was a military guy, which was really important from the point of view that put him squarely in the tradition established by, first of all, Augustus, but also Tiberius, because Tiberius is a military guy as well. And it broke the oddity of Caligula in the meantime, who was more of a showman. So what happens in AD 43, there are two commanders, most famous we know Aulus Plautius, but there was Saturninus also, who is mentioned, I think, in Orosius. It was a campaign of four legions under two commanders who set off from the coast of Gaul. They cross the English Channel. They land at maybe two points. One is the south coast. Maybe one is in the area of Kent. And we seem to think it's at Richborough, because that becomes the entry point to what will become the province of Britain. It's a Rutupiae. And then along the coast, it seems to be that it was a landing at or very close to Fishbourne in West Sussex. There was a palace built in later ages. But before the palace, there seems to have been some early Roman installation or Roman-inspired installation, which appears to be something like a granary. And there's some speculation here is that the Romans weren't working in isolation. The British at the time, the Iron Age Britons, Celts, if you will, were tribal in nature and were warring with each other. So the Celtiberloni, for example, of the middle of the country, and the Regni of the south, for example, the Cantii out in Kent, and the big tribe, the Trinoantes, who were out in what we now consider to be the Colchester area, were vying for control of the country. And every so often, one of the people would come over into the Roman Empire and say, I'd like to form an alliance with you. I will support you. And would you support me? And there's an inference maybe that, in fact, before the Romans invaded, they had already got some diplomatic leverage with tribes, one of which would have been the Regni, who are this tribe that exists in the south of the country between West Sussex principally and the Isle of Wight. And that becomes one of the landing spots. It's really intriguing. If it's possible that the infrastructure in Chichester predates 43 AD, does that mean there was a Roman detachment perhaps active already? Or what was going on there exactly? The archaeology can't tell us much more than the fact that these structures are there and there's militaria that we can pick from there. But the local king, Togidubnus, is instrumental in helping and assisting one of the landing army groups to be able to get a foothold and be able to start moving south and southwest. Interesting enough, Legio II Augusta under Vespasian is the man active. And then the other part of the campaign goes up through the Thames, the Medway, and that way, and then over a period all the way through to 54, secures these, either defeating the tribes as they find them or basically saying, we're your friends, we've arrived, and hold this for us as we move northwest and southwest. So Claudius is able to achieve quick gains, famously arriving in what was Camulodunum, which was the Trinovantes' head city. And with them at a short order, that they basically set up the trapping so he can arrive with elephants. So he actually has this triumphal parade through this Iron Age British oppidum, as it would have been, and with elephants. Of course, Britons wouldn't have seen elephants, so you can only imagine what consternation that would have created. But they were very, very clearly anticipating victory. I mean, they brought all their trappings with them, going to celebrate this day, all of which is great, because when he comes back to Rome, and he actually makes a point of going the route which would have actually been the route that his father had established. So he actually comes back through this road, which is the Via Claudia Augusta, which goes basically all the way through the north side, through the Four Alpenland, down through the Alps there, arriving finally at Pons Drusi, which is Bolzano, at the Tridentum, Trento, and then finally all the way down. So he's making that very clear historical and diplomatic and military connection with his dad. And guess what he does after that? They mint a whole new set of coins. And remember, the ones before had his father's head with the emblems of De Germanis from Germany. Now they say Der Britannis. So he's able to sort of say, my dad did Germany, I did Britain. And they both have triumphal arches with pictures of captive Britons or Germans, as the case may be. So by AD 43, going into AD 44, he's now established that he's no fool. He's a successful, victorious commander-in-chief. He's imperator. He's the commander. And I think it was quite brilliant how he did it. He was very good to have such good deputies that he could entrust the whole campaign to. And once they had actually secured their foothold in Britain, they just kept moving ever westwards, ever northwards.
So, of course, there is some years in between that we had to move on, I'm afraid. So let's talk about the death of Claudius, because I believe the rumor goes that he was poisoned by Agrippina the Younger, who, of course, had motives in putting her son, Nero, on the throne. Or is this just a rumor? Was it possible for a heart attack or a natural death? It was, as we mentioned, it was quite old. It must have been around 60 at this point. It was 51 when it came in, and he'd been on the throne for 10 years, so he must have survived. So medical disease should have been a cause, natural cause as well. But was it, as we think the rumor goes, that he was poisoned by his wife, Agrippina, to put her son, as so the sources say, I think, that she would have Nero on the throne?
Well, let's be careful with our words here. Is 63 old?
For the time.
Well, but remember,
corrected.
Augustus was 75 and Tiberius was 77. That's my point. No, I think that it's interesting, isn't it? Because we're talking life expectancy where they actually lived ages. And once Romans had got beyond that dangerous piece of the first 9 or 10 years, some could live quite long ages. So I just point that out. But to your point, so yes, the story of mushrooms. Claudius is portrayed in the sources. He loves wine. He loves food, and he has a particular taste for mushrooms. So the question is, were they poisoned, or did he by accident eat poisonous mushrooms? Because it's quite possible that, you know, somebody picked the wrong ones and he didn't know, and he actually got poisoned naturally rather than by some sinister conspiracy. We can't really know. This is the problem. But it suits the story that we're told through Tacitus and Suetonius and Cassius Dio as part of this idea of this powerful woman who has designs for her son that she would try and bump him off. I mean, you know, arguably, he could have just carried on. I mean, he was, what I said, he was 63. He might have lived on two more years, and he died, and Nero already was marked out to be his successor. So, you know, was she in a hurry? Maybe. Did he die of natural causes? I can't say, but the story of the poisoning is certainly one that is in the sources. And
is it in
that,
other sources as well, or is it just one source that reported it was poisoned?
I don't recall. I'll be very honest, I don't recall. But I wanted to make this point, that there is a trope, right? And remember Livia Drusilla, right? Augustus's wife. Okay, she was also accused or maligned or implicated in poisonings of members, either of her family or the people who might have got in the way of her family. And you know, even Cleopatra, for example, there's poison involved in her death. So this idea that women in powerful positions will resort not to a dagger, I'm holding a paper opener here, a letter opener, but you know, holding, they wouldn't rely on a weapon. No, they'd be much more, you know, subtle and clever in the way that they might administer that. So it fits also a trope. Right, that a woman with ambition and maybe evil intent will resort to poison because, hey, they all do that, right? Mm-hmm. And I can't say. I think the other thing to think here really is that Claudius was known to be sick and he did have stomach problems. Was that like a stomach ulcer or was that food poisoning? I don't know. I mean, you've got to remember in a lot of the Roman homes that cleanliness that we would expect. Like they weren't using bleach to clean countertops, and the toilet was often right next to the cooker. So human excrement is very close to food. So I think food poisoning and these sorts of things were probably quite common. I don't know that people are necessarily in the habit of washing their hands. I mean, they go to the baths every day, we're told. And even those may not have been particularly clean because, of course, people are taking everything they got with them and that's all ending up in the water too. So I think there's a risk factor here that just daily life could be dangerous. And it just so happens that he was married to Agrippina and mushrooms and then he dies and then people join these things up and say, ah, he was poisoned.
But I do think I want to go back to saying what I said before, that I think he was genuinely a good emperor and that there should be six emperors, and Claudius should be among them. Of course, there are probably more than just five good emperors, but he should be among one of those good emperors that we can consider.
Well, and the Romans recognized it to this degree. He was deified after he died, right? So I think that says a lot. I mean, if you look at the 12 Caesars under Suetonius, not all of them were deified. In fact, the majority were not. So that tells you a great deal, I think. And it's just very interesting that in this place called Camulodunum, which actually was Colonia Victricanensis, that in fact there was a temple to him in Britain. And it's just, I think, really interesting that it was a big temple. It wasn't a small one, it was a big one. In fact, the Colchester Museum in Colchester is built within the brick superstructure that was the podium. And you can still go in there and actually see the supporting arches that held this great big temple within this huge big precinct. I mean, it was a destination to go to. So when a traveller left Gaul, traversed the English Channel, the ocean, as it would have been then, and they arrive at Rutupiae, Reculva, they would have gone through a massive arch. It was a quadrifons. It was a four-arched victory arch, and then they were taking the road, and they could have branched off if they wanted to the culture to go and see that on their way to Londinium, and I think that speaks volumes that he was regarded that highly that he was deified. So Romans actually did regard him, I think, on balance, as a good man. He instituted, as I said, there were crucial refinements that he did to the army, which enabled it to exist for at least another 150 years, certainly all the way through to Hadrian without much change at all. And that was essential because it was the Roman army that was the power behind the princeps. And above and beyond that, I mean, he fixed certain things within the Roman system, which were creaking and a little bit inefficient. The Porta Ostia was a major thing, which actually long existed after him all the way until Trajan. So that was a major thing. So I think a lot of people would have looked at that and sort of say, yeah, good guy.
So, of course, let's talk about Nero's accession to the throne, which, as we talked about a few times now, he would become the heir to the empire. And what I, of course, want to talk about as well, his relation with Agrippina, because his mother-son relationship, as we will see, was not the best, let's be fair.
Are we even allowed to? Is it suitable for publication?
We could try. I mean, if we are castle, we'll see. Yeah.
So here's the situation as we understand it. So Claudius is dead. A young 25-year-old now effectively is the heir to succeed, but there is his brother, who's Britannicus. And the story is that Britannicus chokes on, I think it's a date stone or something like that, and in fact is eliminated during a banquet or just a standard Roman dinner, leaving Nero basically to be princeps without rival. And the personality of Nero, ironically, like Caligula, was he had no military experience. Ironically, his father, Domitius Ahenobarbus, was a military guy. In fact, he'd actually been involved up in the conquest of Germany at one point, taking the legions all the way to the Elbe River. But his son didn't have any of those sorts of things. In fact, his interests were in what we describe as the arts and the humanities. And the problem that he faced was that Romans looked at that very with a frown on their face, because a Roman leader was not supposed to sing songs and act on the stage. And if you did, actors were really quite low on the social order.
Sorry for interrupting you, but we mentioned this before on the podcast, that in ancient times, especially medieval times as well, it's really a quite recent phenomenon that actors are quite famous and looked up to as they are today. Back in those days, it was the low, like you said, it was the lowest class, and you did not want to be associated in those guys. It was on the level of prostitution, basically.
Yes, I think the profession of acting, i.e. not being who you are, the authentic you, and actually wearing a mask. Don't forget that actors in those days were going to wear platform shoes, exotic costumes, and these enormous masks, which were stereotyped as the tragedy, that the sad man, the angry man, the funny man, the slave, the woman. And in fact, if you look at some of the mosaics that come from Pompeii and elsewhere in the Roman Empire, they show these. This all appealed to Nero. He enjoyed being a performer, and when you sort of see his principate within the terms of that, it makes more sense. But it was increasingly outrageous to people in the Roman elite, I suppose it could be. I mean, his mother probably encouraged it because that enabled her to kind of do what she wanted to do. And of course, she was now working. I think she was actually a lover of Narcissus, who was one of Claudius's freedmen. So she was able to sort of pull levers and things like that behind the scenes. Oh, by the way, I just wanted to point out that when we were talking about Claudius earlier, in Suetonius, there's very clear statements there that saying a lot of these great ideas about reforming things and buildings weren't Claudius's ideas. They were his two freedmen and his wives. And the wives could be Messalina, but I'm thinking also Agrippina. So we have to sort of bear that in mind. And that was also outrageous to Romans, because what do you mean we've got freedmen? We've got women running the show? What is this about? So the fact that Nero comes out of this and wants to be an actor, a singer, and a star is a bit of a shock, you know? Because again, they have to reset the Roman principate. I mean, they're now looking at number five and they're wondering, what's this going to be like? And what they get is this guy who's young, kind of charming, apparently got some talent, starts off pretty well, actually engages the Senate with things. He sort of resets with them because Claudius became more and more controlling in a way. He'd actually brought more of the decision-making into his office, and Nero kind of gives it back to the Senate to be able to work. So initially, there's a good response to this, and it may well be that working in tandem with his mother, they were able to get some good things moving along there. And at that time, Britain, the conquest is still going on like that. There are no major issues within the Roman Empire within the first 5 or so years, so things look good in that time, 1851.
I want to bring you up as well, and again, I'm referring, as I've done quite a lot, and I'm sorry for referring to the episode with Anthony Barrett again, but I want to bring up, he mentioned something interesting as well, that the senators that appointed Caligula to the throne also were alive in the time of Nero, and they were also the one to appoint Nero to the throne. Of course, I don't think they had an idea what they were in for at the time, but it's an interesting point that those appointed Caligula to the throne also appointed Nero as well.
Well, it hints, doesn't it, that they must have got something out of it, right? So senators were not really supposed to be getting their hands in commerce. I mean, that's what the equestrian order did. But they were, big farm holders, and so they made a lot of money. And the fact is that they probably stood to benefit by having someone that they had appointed as opposed to somebody else that they had not appointed. So better your guy than their guy. I think that's part of it. And again, maybe promises were made by Agrippina to some of these people that, we're going to run a tight show here. We've got a clear agenda what we're going to do. We're not going to act like Caligula did. We're actually going to spend money wisely, and trust us, it'll be a good show.
But also, I want to mention that, and I kind of want to draw a parallel here with a later emperor. When you mentioned, you're going to talk about, of course, Nero does throw Joan to Greece in a moment, but I wanted, and it's not for acting, as I talked about, it kind of draws a parallel to Commodus, who loved gladiator games and wanted to be in the arena by gladiators. It kind of makes you think they're kind of similar in a sense, both those emperors.
I think what it highlights is that the Roman style of succession, which the first point of call was to appoint your own kin, right? And it wasn't going to be a woman, it was going to be a man, restricted the talent pool. Right. So in the Julio-Claudians under Augustus, he actually tried to nominate different people, but through disease, sickness, and injury on the battlefield, his choices narrowed down to one man. By the time he got to Tiberius, he'd run out of choices. There really only was Caius Caligula left, and Caius Caligula didn't get to make a choice. He was killed before he got there. And again, in the case of Claudius, he decided to sideline his own natural son in favor of his wife's son. And, why he did that, you can speculate on. And certainly Robert Graves in I, Claudius seems to suggest that was because he wanted to bring back the Republic. But that's I'm sure, totally fictional. So in the case of Nero, you've got an individual here who has got immense power, enormous amounts of money to be able to do. And the world's the plaything, right? He can do what he wants to do. He gets married to a woman that he is in love with for a while, and then things start going off the rails. He arranges for her to be bumped off. He falls in love with Poppaea, right, who is another lady, and now we begin to see some of the rather strange behaviors that come out. There's the public face. I mean, literally, the face you see on the coins changes, and it's fascinating. If you take within the first 1 or 2 years of his reign in 54, you see this kind of young, quite athletic looking profile, and then it ages as he goes through. And by the time you get to his 30th year, he came in at 17, he dies at 30. He looks really quite unhealthy. He's got this thick double chin, and he's got this sort of rather scrappy beard that grows right under his chin.
He kind of looks demonic in a way, doesn't he?
Well, so that's an interesting point. We think that, but he must have thought, and the suggestion is that he would have seen the images that go on the coins. I mean, he seemed to worry about everything else. So he must have picked the images. He must have thought that that image projected strength and vigor. And, you know, this is what an emperor should look like. And maybe he was inspired by some portraits that he saw on Greek coins or some of the other client kingdoms and so forth. And of course, they're wonderfully engraved. I mean, these are really works of art. So under Nero, you get the sense that because he is himself an artist, he appreciates that works, so invests in things. But that must be an image that he wants people to see. And we now don't get that message because we think, well, this just looks like a man who's out of shape and just hasn't shaved in a while. But, you know, maybe he thinks, maybe this is what a strong Greek athlete looks like, because he's a bit of he's a Hellenist. He actually likes the heritage of the Greek world. So he actually begins to spend more time in Greece. He becomes a charioteer. He actually wins chariot races. He takes part.
I mean, of course he won. He's the emperor. Who's going to defeat the emperor?
Well, yeah, and maybe you'd be a fool to sort of make sure that your chariot, you know, doesn't take over his. Yes, and it's interesting, by the way, that when I was researching Germanicus at Olympia, there's an inscription where, in fact, either he or a chariot that he had actually sponsored also won. So these people kind of played the game along that. You know, hey, yeah, it's just for 1 year. He won't be back next year. We can all have a fair competition next year. But, you know, this whole idea of Nero's got talent, right? It's a sort of the celebrity showman type that is different. I mean, no other emperor has done this. But actually, in his private life, I don't know that, other than his mother, who might be the one that's saying no. So the relationship between him and her breaks down. And I was talking about Octavia and Poppaea. In the meantime, the stories go, and this is where we get to the adult bit, is that in order to sort of try and keep his attention on the things that she wants him to do, she offers herself to him to have sex with, which is a pretty appalling thought. But again, this sort of suggests that the corruption and depravity of Roman morals within this family at this point, and it's another rather kind of eyebrow-raising story, but it's the sort of thing that, and again, Tacitus and Suetonius telling people about would lead to inevitable downfall. I mean, it's the sort of corruption that would seem to be there. The story is that in order to get his mother out of the way, he invites her to, I think it's the other side of the Bay of Naples, and then on the return journey, she goes on this boat, and the boat is designed to fall apart and sink. And there have been experiments to try and build one, because there's slightly different interpretations and in the three sources that we have. The boat actually doesn't sink, as it turns out. So what he, instead of her drowning, he then has to trump up charges so that she, in fact, can be executed. And by this time, she's so disgusted by her own son that she basically tells the guy with the sword, stick it here, pointing to her middle section, basically saying, this is what gave him birth, stab me here. And it's a rather sort of heroic but also awful picture. And in fact, you know, that the execution takes place, and Nero comes along, looks at the body and sees her naked and begins to realize she really was quite beautiful, wasn't she? And you know, it's all rather, you know, unpleasant when you think about it. But
I want to talk about as well that you and the story where he tries to drown his mother when she's on a boat, and she does manage to swim to the shore and just brush up and then moves on, basically.
Yeah. So again, I mean, that points to her being an immensely strong woman physically, right? Mm. But the undercurrent of that is that she'd lost control of the story and the control of her son. And you know, he was more interested in his performance arts and having people bow to his will. And of course, he famously kicks one of his wives to death, effectively. So you see really a kind of mental breakdown or tyranny, someone who can't control his emotions. And I would say to that is that he's surrounded, once his mother's off the, there's nobody around him that's saying no, maybe bar two people. And he starts his prince of with two people who seem to be good influences. One is Burrus, who is his Praetorian cohort commander, who seems to be eminently sensible. But the other one is Seneca the Younger, who's the playwright, this philosopher, whose works survive in large amounts. And he was a writer on ethics and living a moral life and these sorts of things. So, and he wrote speeches so that Nero would actually read speeches that Seneca had actually written for him. And then when those people go off the stage, there's basically the guardrails are taken off, and he can just be the powerful autocrat with nobody saying that's a bad idea. And then we have the fire of Rome.
Before we move on, I want to talk to the Red Fire. I want to talk about his mother a bit. Talk about, some stories that she poisoned her husband and yada yada yada. But how much of that is propaganda that kind of portrays her in a bad light, and how much do we know that she really was this manipulative woman, and that she really wanted power for herself, and how much do we know that is actually true, and what is propaganda?
I don't know in all truth that we can really know, because again, you look at the sources, okay? So Tacitus is writing really about the way that Roman politics declines. And his reference point is some sort of memory of a Roman Republic that functioned in a sort of fair and sane way. And when was that? Was that the 5th century or the 4th century? We're never quite clear when that is. He was kind of like make Rome great again kind of camp, if you will. There's the trope, though, that this is a woman, and Romans had a natural sort of distrust of powerful women. Now, we haven't got to talk about Boudica much. We will do. The other side of this is that, for example, you can pick examples of the Ethiopian queen Kandake, Amirenas, for example, under the time of Augustus, who seemed to be able to give the Romans a run for their money. Then we've got Cleopatra, of course, who gave Mark Antony and Augustus a reason to be bothered, and ultimately, you know, she was taken off the scene completely. And Livia is another example of a strong woman, and the way that she's portrayed in the Roman accounts is someone who has an agenda that's maneuvering behind the scenes for her interests rather than either her husband's or for the good of the Roman Republic. And again, it's very hard. If those are tropes, if those are things which become like stereotypes, it's very hard to know whether Agrippina the Younger was, if you use the word, wicked like that, or whether that's a fabrication of propaganda. And I also, the first thing to notice is that one of the first coins that's minted when Nero comes to the throne is a picture of him and his mother. I mean, I don't think there are any other coins that have literally the autocrat with the mother, right? I mean, this is just unbearable. There's also an account where one of the first passwords that he gives to his commander is Optima Mater, basically the best mother. So you know, this young 25-year-old must at this point think the world of her. It's just that, does she become overbearing? Does he just sort of say, well, I'm actually the boss and you can't tell me what I want to do? And then this all kind of breaks down after that point. And of course, you know, he seems to have a high libido as well. So, you know, the fact that he wants to do what he can and nobody can stop him. So it's really hard to know, because our sources tend to be biased, and there's a reason why they tell you what they tell us.
And you mentioned Boudica. So let's talk a little bit about the 6th Boudica revolt around 60 AD, and how we don't have to go into too much detail, because of course that is an episode in itself. So let's talk more. Let's talk a little bit about the Boudica revolt, because I know you
Let's do that. There's a couple of authors I could suggest to you, but the essence of it is this: that the story as we have it is that the Romans tend to be a bit heavy-handed when they enter new territory, and what made the Roman conquest
a little bit
Britain, and I alluded to it earlier. Well, so for example, that not all of Britain was Roman; they had client kings or client queens. And I mentioned Togedubnus earlier, who actually was a king of the Regni, which seems to have been an offshoot of the Atrebates down in the south of Britain. The other tribes were basically conquered, but the people who basically were clients, allies, were basically left alone. they had maybe to provide supplies and equipment to the invading army, probably on demand, but they were basically allowed to run. And up in the north, there were the Brigantes, where King Prasutagus entered into a deal with Claudius, so he was left to run his affairs. And in the case of the Iceni, who were the tribe that basically own what we now talk of Norfolk, going, I think, into Cambridgeshire, the deal with the king there was the same kind of terms. While you're alive, we will respect your territory, but when you die, this becomes part of the Roman Imperium. And this part of the deal didn't seem to be either understood or the memo hadn't got to his daughters. And that the way it's portrayed is that the Iceni, in the meantime, had been borrowing money from Roman moneylenders to do their own projects with, because no doubt this was the first time they'd been actually offered money. And the army, I guess, comes to enforce, we're coming here to collect the money. And they said, what money? You know, we thought this was a gift. And it turns out that was a misunderstanding, whereupon Boudica's daughters apparently are raped. And in this outrage, Boudica, as the mother, understandably wants revenge, wants the culprits, and the Romans look from the top, we don't understand what the problem is. You know, this is now our territory. Oh, by the way, you need to start paying back on your loans. And she then forms an alliance with the Trinovantes, the Catuvellauni, and the Iceni. So basically that takes the middle eastern sector of the British Isles into a situation of revolt. And to collapse this whole thing, which happened between either 61 or 60, it's not quite clear from the dating, but as we have it, she basically, with her alliance, they strike Colchester, they strike St. Albans, they strike London. And effectively, London is not even a city in the sense it has a status. It's a place of commerce. That's burned. St. Albans burned, Colchester burned. And this is famously where the Temple of Claudius is, and the veterans are based. And the veterans put up a stiff resistance, but even they can't overcome this marauding war band of three tribes. And they start moving across the country. Interestingly enough, the provincial governor, I think it's Paulinus, is actually out campaigning in North Wales. I'm from Wales, so this is close to home for me. And he's out on the Isle of Anglesey defeating Druids, who they see as being the sort of last point of national resistance, the resistance to having actually under Caratacus has since failed, and the Druids are seen as the last point, and they have to capture them. So while he is away, the British resistance spreads. So finally, he comes in and defeats them at a battle. We don't quite know where that battle took place. There are several suggestions where it might be, and it seems to be somewhere in the Midlands of the United Kingdom. And she's either killed on the battlefield, or she goes away and either commits suicide or is killed that way. But the point is, we don't know where she's buried. All sorts of interesting theories about that. But the Romans get control back of the island at that point. And all this is happening under Nero, and this is all rather embarrassing, because the campaign had been going so well under Claudius, and it sort of hits the brakes at this point with great cost associated with it. I mean, you know, the destruction of three major cities is something to be worried about. And in fact, they almost lose Britannia at this point. It's kind of near-run thing. But what's remarkable is when you look at the archaeology, there's a layer of black ash in these cities, which archaeologists do find. The speed of recovery is the thing that's remarkable. But literally within a year, 2 years, they're rebuilding. So the Roman project to establish Britannia is a go, that the Romans are committed to making this happen. I mean, there are four legions. They're now scattered around the country, so that the legions of they've gone as far southwest as they can in Vespasian, and they relocate to South Wales, first in Usk, then in Caerleon, which is where they're based. They're up in Deva, Chester, and they're going up to Lincoln in the north part. So really, there's this great big fan of the great big rump of the south, the Midlands, Wales, and the southwest are effectively under Roman control. But the degree to which it's Romanized, that's the stuff that archaeologists and historians still debate, because just because you actually build a city doesn't mean that all the land around it is Roman. The big challenge that they always have in this process of Romanization is the degree to which they can bring the tribal elites on board, and then their followers and their their courtiers then follow them. And it takes them a generation or two or three to actually make this work. And in fact, in some parts of Britain, even all the way up to the time of Hadrian, they don't really succeed. And, you know, that's a whole other podcast, which hopefully we can do another time. But under Nero, he manages through his generals to pull it from the brink of disaster. But it was really very near to being lost.
And of course, let's talk about before we go to talk about some of the things that people probably most associate with Nero the Great fire in 64. But I want to talk a little bit before this is a new religion that entered the chat, and that is Christianity, which is a bit troublesome for the Romans. So let's talk a little bit about Christianity in Rome, because they kind of, and again, we'll see this in the Great Fire, that they become, as the Jews would be later, in for the Christians, they do become the scapegoats of the Roman world, at least early on in their history.
Well, it's a big subject, right? So we haven't got much time here. So I mean,
a bit controversial, maybe.
well, that too, but it's an interesting area to discuss. So that the early Christians were actually Jews. So Christianity is rooted in the Judaic tradition of Mosaic law, the law of Moses. So are they identifying themselves as Christians in the way we think of themselves, or are they really just Jews who have now seen the Messiah? They've chosen to believe that the Messiah has come. And the traditional Jewish interpretation would be, well, the Jewish Messiah, the Mashiach, was going to be a leader that would bring the tribes together, would establish the freedom of the land of Israel, Judea. But clearly this man had died on a cross. So that sort of, for a lot of Jews, didn't gel. That was kind of a contradiction. He couldn't be the Messiah because he died. The real one will actually be alive, and then the country will thrive. Well, in this instance, it seems to be that little communities spread across initially the Near East. So we're talking the Levant area. So that would be Judea, Syria, going into Egypt. A lot of it comes down to the proselytizing of either Saul, famous Saul of Tarsus, Paul, and we know from his writings, I mean, there's the earliest ones in the Christian tradition, where he is writing directly to these individual communities or churches to inspire them. And where he goes on his tours is to be able to bolster them and help them spread, I guess the expression is the good word. He, of course, is himself a Roman, but he's a Jewish Roman, which leads to some very interesting things, because he causes a great many in the Jewish community to be upset, because he's basically telling a different version of their tradition, from the Torah. And on the other hand, you've also got the story of St. Peter, right? So you've got these two towering figures within the Christian tradition. In the case of Paul, he tours Asia Minor, motivating the communities. He basically is arrested in Jerusalem because he takes this proselytizing too far. The Jews complain. He's arrested, and there's the famous scene where, of course, the tribune takes him, and the centurion is just about to whip him, because a non-Roman does not have the protection that a Roman does. And basically, a Roman citizen just simply says, "Civis Romanus sum," I am a Roman citizen. And they basically have to stand back. They can't harm that person anyway. It's nearly always a man. They can't harm him in any way. So in this instance, the story is that, you know, they basically tear his tunic, and they just about to whip him. And he says, "Civis Romanus, is this how you treat a Roman citizen?" And the tribune goes, "Oh, wow, gosh, you didn't say that before." And they have to basically let him go. And in fact, their idea is to hand him back to the Pharisees and the Jewish Council of High Priests. But he basically invokes, "I would like to be tried." So they take him to Caesarea with this armed escort. And the intention is that he will actually go to face trial by the emperor, and that the charge presumably is sedition, something like that. And then he embarks on this journey. And of course, there's the shipwreck and all the rest of it. So his legend grows. In the meantime, there's Peter, who at the time of Nero is one of those people who is arrested and thrown to the circus, where he meets his fate there. So these two kind of things. So you've got the tradition of Peter, and Paul. But all the while, there are these little communities, and they seem to be the disaffected people, you know, the people who are encouraged by this idea that if you live this life well, there is an afterlife, which, as I understand it in the Jewish tradition, there isn't. It's about living a good life now and actually living according to the laws of Moses and being an ethical person within the prescriptions of the Torah and all the other documents that define the Jewish tradition. So this is where Christianity was different. That the problem is it challenged the Roman way of looking at the world, which is, for example, it's not monotheistic. So in the same way the Jews had their Yahweh, so the Christians had Yahweh by effectively another name, but they certainly rejected any calls to you must respect the divinity of the emperor, the fact that he in fact is the link between effectively the Olympian gods and human society. They rejected that outright, and that was a problem. That's where things got tricky, because as long as you went along with it, as long as you observed the holidays and the feasts, you could choose any god you liked. You could be any culture you liked. They just all got along. And in that way, Roman society was very permissive. It's just when other people would rub against that, and the Jews hit it regularly when in the Greek communities, the Greeks would say, hey, we're having the feast for Hermes. And then the Jews would respond, no, that's Shabbat. We can't do anything on the Shabbat because that's when we focus on our traditions and on our God. And then they would be accused of not being citizens, and there would be all this sort of thing going on. There'd be riots in places like Alexandria and so on. And this is the sort of thing that sort of began to characterize Christianity. So the Romans tend to look at those as being troublemakers. And the net result of that is that you might have some extremes within Christianity who see this as being, let's fast track this. If the point is to get to end of days, right, to actually bring about the kingdom of God, let's not wait. Let's bring this right now. And this is where things seem to intersect with the great fire of Rome. And the archaeology says one story, but is there maybe an incident which triggers this thing? I don't know, but there's this tradition by the 50s and 60s AD of a sort of darkening of that the world is coming to an end. And, you know, we've seen in our own days that there will be cults that believe that you know the world's coming to an end and we all have to prepare for this, and then of course the day comes and they just respond, we got the day wrong. So there's a suggestion that maybe that Christians were doing this and they're associated with the fire of Rome. I think the archaeology shows it was a hot sunny day, a bakery had a furnace going and somebody wasn't tending to it, just like the fires of London in 1666. And unfortunately, large up to 15% of the city was destroyed over a period of days, they were scapegoats. They got to be the ones that carried the can for it.
And let's talk about Nero's role on this, because of course, as we talked about off the camera and off the record, and of course we mentioned, and most people probably associate Nero with is that he fiddled in Rome, and as I said, we talked about this before we recorded, that there most people would say no, he didn't, because there was no fiddle in that time, but it shouldn't be that there was, you know, the harp that was kind of coded as fiddle, as far as I understand, but of course, I'm referring to Anthony Barrett's book here, which I've mentioned quite a few times, I'm sorry for that, but still, in the Rome is Burning, which he wrote a while ago, he mentioned that Nero can be blamed for many things, but the fire of Rome is not one of them. And because he was quite far away from Rome at the time, he was at a park, outside the city.
Yes, he was an Antium. And so the fire started out apparently on the 19th of July, 64. And my notes here, it began at night in a shop beside the Circus Maximus, which is the racetrack between the Aventine and Palatine Hills. Wind fanned the flames. Suetonius states that the fire lasted six days and seven nights. Tacitus mentions that the fire halted, but flared up again after the sixth day. A fact supported by Domitianic, an inscription, which refers to 9 days of burning, taking the event to the 28th of July. So So Nero was not in Rome on the 19th of July, maybe even the 20th of July. And from what we can gather, it was only when his own house started burning, then he came in because, you know, his stuff was being burned and he was concerned about that. So about 15% of the city was burned. And in fact, in Barrett's book, there's a map there. It's a great big black blob in the heart of the city. Now, as we were talking earlier, fires happened regularly in Rome. Floods happened regularly in Rome. Famine happened regularly in Rome. I mean, for the city at this time is not really the big city of monuments, a lot of marble buildings and all the rest of it. And as you pointed out, the Colosseum wasn't built at this point. That comes later. So we've got a city which has got lots of winding streets and tall buildings which are not well built. They're rickety. They're a lot of them made of wood and wattle and daub type of thing, and sometimes they fall down. But the point is they're basically fire hazards. And the result of that is if you get a fire in a barn, in a bakery, you know, on a dry night with a wind blowing, the embers can fly around, and before you know it, you've got one building burning. And as we were talking, you know, about, for example,
imagine the one guy going home from that bakery. Did I leave a stone down?
Say that again.
Imagine the one guy that comes home from that bakery and wonder, did I leave a stone down?
Yeah, well, but see again, I mean, there are parallels with like the Great Fire of London. I mean, you know, that's supposed to, I think, start in Pudding Lane, and that was all totally innocent, and of course, you know, nobody knew that until much later. But the point is, the consequences of the fire in London and in Rome were profound because you had this great big swathe of city right in the heart, which was burned down. I mean, the Romans lost cultural monuments, they lost documents, they lost trophies, and lots of stuff which really was historical meaningful to them, just as in happened in Rome. But what's interesting, bringing it back to Nero, he didn't go sing with a fiddle. The fiddle didn't come until the 16th, 17th century, so that's just an historical anomaly. The other thing, suggestion, is that he might, well, because he was an artist and a singer, he would be dressed as a Kithoroidus in his long gown, and he'd be plucking away at a lyre. Well, that all seems to be arrant nonsense. He may have just simply, like Sulla did, by the way, I think with Carthage, quote from Homer or something about how, you know, the city was burning, and then some other people spread, oh, Nero mentioned that. And of course, they make up this story. But actually what Nero did is, for the people who were blighted, like Tiberius and other people before him, they opened up public buildings, they opened up parks, they provided accommodations as far as they could, because, you know, I'm in a city of about 750,000 people, something like that, maybe a million. You know, a lot of these people suddenly lost everything. And you know, so there were those needs to be dealt with. There was the need to feed, clothe, and house these people. And it would be many years before they rebuild for ordinary people. And in that regards, emperors, and this is a point that Barrett makes in his book, in times of crisis like that, emperors could be really good. Tiberius actually compensated people when their buildings burned down in the 20s AD, and Nero did the same thing. And yeah, this is the sort of thing they thought of being. They seemed to be ultimately the patron of the people, and they would do what they could to actually make things right. What went slightly wrong and then became really seriously wrong was that with so much land now available, Nero took the decision to actually build this enormous public park, and it really was public rather than just an exclusive, like a manor house, private grounds, the famous Domus Aurea, the Golden House. And what we know from archaeology, because it's now been discovered in recent times, and you can even visit it when the building's open, it's basically a huge swath of parkland with a huge big lake, a sort of man-made lake, surrounded by porticos, with a long gallery of colonnaded buildings, one of which had a high sort of domed ceiling, and apparently the stone could spin around. And all of these buildings were decorated to the highest standards of the day, I mean, with some of the best mosaics ever made at that time, and the decorations of the walls. And all of this can be seen in the much that has survived. And the optics were terrible. So he may have had this idea, we've all suffered a big disaster. Hey, I'm turning this into parkland, which we can all enjoy. It's an amenity for the people. It doesn't appear they saw it that way. They were hurting, and they were seeing all this money being spent on what would seem to be a glamour project, a vanity project. And it had the effect of really not only ruining his reputation, which had been pretty good up to that point, and like I said earlier, he'd actually helped people in the fire, but the damage to the economy of 15% of the city being ripped out, I mean, they started debasing the coins. So they, it was literally hitting people in their pockets as far as they had pockets at all. So, you know, there's a personal impact for this vanity project, which is obviously costing a lot of money. Now, the other side would be, well, he would employ a lot of people to build this. So ironically, you could say this is a sort of Keynesian economics project where, you know, people do the work, you know, he pays them and they can rebuild their lives. But, you know, 64 to 68, 4 years. I mean, this is being built really, really, really fast, right? And it's being built to a very high standard. But these people still haven't got their houses really restructured and so on. And it sets up antagonism at a very high level between the Senate and between the emperor. And outside of Rome, people see this as being a grotesque development. And it comes to a head, really. There's a revolt of the army in Gaul under a man called Vindex. And that's the first problem. The Jews in Judea in 66 are revolting as well. So 2 years after the fire run, there are now two big problems. One is in Gaul, the other one is in Judea. So now he's fighting not only an economic and reurbanization problem in the city of Rome, he's now got two wars to fight. And this really challenges him as a leader. And I think people at that point say, this man is more interested in singing and art and building a palace than actually dealing with the fundamental problems. And then it all goes horribly wrong after that point.
Hmm. And of course, you mentioned his wife Pompeia, who he eventually kills. And there is a story that he finds a slave, I think, or eunuch, and dresses him up as Pompeia, and he had to pretend to be his wife because it kind of looked like her, because it didn't seem to genuinely love her, but the story kind of tells you how kind of went off the rails a bit.
So there were two male slaves. One was Sporus, and the other was Pythagoras. And I think it was Sporus that he had castrated, and he would take him to Greece on his campaigns. And what's remarkable is how few years all this is happening. And so he marries this person in public, right? Which again, even to the broad-minded Romans, was a grotesque sort of abuse of his position. I think they would have tolerated it had it been in private, but he sort of rubbed their faces in this, and he could make the point, this is all dramatic and I'm an artist, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But to their core, Roman values were actually quite backward looking. They sort of believed in old time virtues, and dressing up in costumes and singing and marrying a man was not one of those things they regarded terribly highly. So this man basically was acting as the lowest kind of human in their eyes, which was unfortunate for him. But yes, so this is apparently what he did, and I think it was Sporus rather than Pythagoras. And it just points to growing chaos, right? So the sort of like torments of people trying to rebuild their lives in Rome, and military uprisings. I mean, when the army starts to lose faith, you have a problem. And interestingly enough, one of the generals that had been involved in sort of setting up a German campaign was one man called Galba. And in the meantime, Galba had gone off to head up the legions in the Iberian Peninsula, in Hispania Tarraconensis, I think, where the army, I think there were three legions at that point, or maybe one. And the Senate looked to him to put a stop to it. They found their man. And now Nero was effectively a man without a following. And it ends up by basically he's declared an enemy of the state. And in fact, they invoke basically a punishment of the old style, which means that whereas before a Roman citizen basically would be allowed to exile themselves, and anybody helping them, they were to deny them water and salt and bread, I think, were the conditions. But in this particular case, the man could be arrested and flogged, which was a terrible humiliation, bearing in mind a Roman citizen was not supposed to be subjected to any of those things. And we talked about that in the context of the later St. Paul. And this was what faced Nero, and then we get into the grand finale at this point.
And speaking of the grand finale, and it is interesting that where Caligula only ruled for 4 years, Nero, who almost was equally as bad as Caligula, was allowed to reign for 14 years.
Right. Which suggests that for most of that time, people liked what he was doing. Right? Or they were just willing to tolerate it. So really what that points to is the events of 66, 64, sort of that window there, leading to the military revolts, is where the whole thing starts to unravel. And of course, he was not a military man. He couldn't go to the legions and say, I am your commander-in-chief, you know, and I've got your best interests at heart, because he probably hadn't been to a military camp. I don't recall a single instance when he did that. So he would not have been taken seriously in the way that a Tiberius or a Germanicus or even a Claudius, because Claudius had that heritage. You've got to remember in this regard that Nero married into the family through his mother, right? And okay, he could point to Domitius Ahenobarbus, was a pretty respected commander, but he didn't have the stature of a Drusus or a Tiberius or a Germanicus to be able to point to. So in that regard, he was a non-entity.
And of course, let's talk about the assassination. He wasn't assassinated, he took suicide, if I remember correctly, because he could not stand being called an enemy of the state, which would be the end of Nero, which would again launch into the year of the four emperors and the rise of the Flavian dynasty, which is a whole other series.
Well, the story that we've got, I think, and I think it is Tacitus, is very dramatic. It reads something, it would make a great episode. If it hasn't already been, I think actually Peter Ustinov did it when he was acting as Nero all those years ago in the 50s. The in essence, having learned that he's public enemy number one and the army's out to get him, the Praetorians are hunting him down, he flees and he's taken with a servant, a slave or a freedman, I forget which, to one of his properties, and it's basically empty. I guess the first instinct is if I hide, I can hide this thing out and calm will prevail and I can come back out again. But that's not how it's going to be. And he tries to commit suicide with some anxiety. And you can only imagine what that feels like. And then finally, it apparently utters the word qualis artifex pereo, which is translated as what an artist dies with me. And he stabs himself. Apparently not so much that he dies instantly or bleeds out totally, by which time a Praetorian cohortsman comes up to basically offer him or to take it out. And he says, you're too late. So you've got this rather bizarre situation. He's being a drama queen, even in his last moments. And it makes a wonderfully dramatic circular story to end that chapter within Tacitus's annals. Because ultimately what he's pointing to is, again, the tragedy of the Roman Republic as it's corroded by ever more mad people. And there are some good people, there are some heroes that stand up to this, and under the treason trials of Tiberius, there are people who try and stand up and defend themselves with honor, and they take their own life. And I was just reading Cordus Cremutius, was a Roman historian, that was accused of writing some defamatory remarks. He apparently praised Cassius and Brutus, which would have been not a problem under Julius Caesar or under Augustus, but apparently it seemed to be a problem for Sejanus specifically. So he addressed the Senate and then went away and starved himself to death. So here's an ordinary senator able to take his life, but Nero has to make a big thing out of it. And to a writer like Tacitus, It's the way you sort of end the story, because now the whole imperial family has come to an end. The Julio-Claudians end with Nero's own death, which is, if you think about all the people, if you go all the way back to Julius Caesar and then with Augustus, all the intricate plans and all the things they try to do, that's how it ended. It's extraordinary. And if you're going to write a story and actually try and convince people of it being a real story, you might have some difficulties, because the people are crazy and they do terrible things, but this apparently is real history.
And let's talk about succession for a bit, because as you know, the year of the four emperors happened outright after the death of Nero, which is a there was no succession that Nero had in mind, but and it's, we've talked about how his wife was pregnant and the huge turn down the stairs, I think, and that's what, and that's how she died. But was there anyone else that could potentially in the Julio-Claudian secular succeed in Nero at this point? I mean, do we know if he had any succession in mind?
I don't know that there were any obvious people at that time, because he hadn't. I mean, he kicked his one wife to death who was carrying the baby. So I mean, that was one potential candidate for succession, but would have been very, very, very young at the time. So that the Senate basically throws its weight behind Galba, who's the military commander, and if you see coins of his, so it's very interesting. So that these candidates for imperial power very quickly used the coins to assert their own control. So Nero dies, and very quickly, because he's aware of what's going on. I mean, you know, he's been declared enemy, and so Galba's army is on the move, and he knows that that's going to end. So very quickly, I don't recall whether it's either mobile mints or maybe it's the mint in Rome, start minting coins with the portrait of Galba, who's got this very stern, kind of really pronounced nose, and looks like a really no nonsense man. You wouldn't want to have an argument with him because he'd shut you down or something. And so he comes onto the scene and rules for about 3 months, as I recall. But in the meantime, what's happened is over in Judea, and I mentioned the 66 where the Jews are revolting. By this time, the Flavian family, comprised of father Vespasian and son Titus, are making quite swift progress. They're going through the Galilee and they're coming down, taking out fortified cities, and they capture one man whose name is Josephus, who's basically sponsored as a Roman citizen, becomes Flavius Josephus. And of course, we could have a whole podcast on Josephus. But the point is, Vespasian himself becomes a candidate. He basically leaves his son to carry on the campaign because the war's still going on there, and he now starts to lead his own counter offensive to actually himself become the princeps. And in the meantime,
but wasn't there a prophecy that Josephus said that something like, "You will make him become emperor, whatever. You will become a great man." So they made it just a policing to survive, but I didn't believe this or something like this.
There is a story, and I think it's actually in Josephus, or maybe in one of the rabbinical texts about how he's a very quick thinker, and in order to save his butt, because the story about Josephus is that he was one of the, I think, commanders at Jotapata, which was one of the strongholds. I think it's in the south part of the Galilee. And they all basically hide in the bowels of this fort. And knowing that the Romans are going to win, they decide the only way out with honor is to commit suicide. So they all take, you know, the short straw, as it were. They all take turns.
Yes, he was a clever chap getting out of that one, wasn't he?
Yeah. So ironically, he contrives, when everybody else has stabbed each other and he's supposed to be the last man who would stab himself, he surrenders. So, you know, I mean,
I don't think you will.
So this is another one of these terrific stories, and maybe that's actually true, I don't know. But that's the story as we get it. And so he presents himself to Vespasian, who say, "What's this Jew doing here? I have no time for this." And say, but I see great things, and you know, he's a writer, and it turns out he can write a story, which we now have as the Bellum Gallic, the Judaicum, the Jewish War, which was written in Greek, that lauds the achievements of this Flavian family and how they are able to crush this this rebellion that breaks down from 66 to finally the fall of Jerusalem in 70, but that's well outside Nero's time. And in the meantime, he's marching ever west with contingents of his army to be able to assert his control. Galba ends up by fighting with another challenger whose name is Otho. So you've got Galba, Otho, and they fight on the Via Postumia, which is the road that runs along the northern part of Italy. And in fact, at this point then, I think Galba's forces... they failed, either not. And then Otho is then facing off with the next one, who's Vitellius, and takes his own life when he sees that there's no route to victory for him. And then finally, there's a showdown between Vitellius and Vespasian, who is the last man standing on the battlefield at this point. And it's amazing. This all happens in the space of a year, the year of four emperors.
And you mentioned that I think got me thinking when you said that the prophecy of, oh, you'll be a great man, and when made last year, which is over the year old, which is crazy to think about. We made an episode about Agrippa, and where he has a similar prophecy as well, that, oh, you will make a great man one day, which it was kind of a common thing to say for you know, this kind of prophecy, those made prophecies that, oh, you will be great, oh, you will do great things.
Well, again, so here's where our style of writing history differs from people of the ancient world. So if you look at Cassius Dio, right, I mean, he's really a chronicler. And he goes year by year by year. And he will go to sometimes great pains to list out the omens of that year. So I was just writing a chapter yesterday on my book about Tiberius, where before he and Augustus go to Gaul in 16 BC, the day after they leave, the omens are terrible. There are ants in the forum. The ants are, you know, swarming, and it's all dreadful. And presumably, you know, you can look up a book of what is the meaning of all these omens and portents, and you can say, yes, a very bad thing. So history is this strange mixture of anecdotes, known events which are recorded in public documents, soothsayers' observations, auguries, these sorts of things, and, you know, the smart man can understand that, well, this is a prediction of that, but because this happened over here. And so, I mean, that's not how we do history now, is it? I mean, we have a humanist approach to history. It's an Enlightenment age objectivity that we try to bring in to our telling. So this is why, in a sense, I know that history comes from the Greek word historia, which means inquiry, but I'm just going to force this sort of association here that ancient history has a lot of emphasis on the story, sometimes more than the inquiry piece. And in the case of our sources, again, you have to understand why the historian, as we would call them, is writing it that way. What's the arching story, the overarching story that they're trying to communicate? And in the case of Cassius Dio, he basically writes this 1,000-year history, right? It's an amazing piece of work from the foundation all the way to his day, which is in the 220s CE. And you were talking about people like Commodus earlier. You know, he sees all these things. Mm. And from him, he's a very proud provincial who becomes a senator. He wants to celebrate the Roman achievement. Tacitus is writing from the point of view of a man disappointed by the time that he has seen how things are not like they used to be. But hey, we're living under Nerva and Trajan now, so maybe things will get better. And then you've got Suetonius, who is able to relate. Well, my grandfather was able to hear about the stories of, you know, Caligula in those days when they were doing those crazy things. And oh, by the way, I happen to be the personal secretary of the Emperor Hadrian, and I have access to all this stuff in the Tabularium. So, you know, it's very interesting how these sorts of things come together to help us. But we have to understand the way they were written and the way they're written and what its purpose was. And then you add in things like archaeology and all the other things, epigraphy and the coins that help us to try and flesh out some of these details. But the frustration is we can't tell what's a story. We can't tell what's a fact. Of course, you can't always be sure that people see the same event the same way. So different tellings of the same event. We were talking earlier about the way that Josephus, in writing, for example, the Jewish war, did so really to show the Flavians in this good light. He did personally very well out of that, that association as being effectively a client of the Flavian family. And in respect of of Tacitus, he was, in a sense, able to look in his own day and try and present that in a positive light because it was so much better. I mean, he'd grown up under the Flavians, and now he was living under what we now consider to be the Antonines. So these were the so-called, as Edward Gibbon would talk, the five good emperors, and he had to live under those days. So he was able to look back at times and try to understand them for what they were, knowing full well that the Res Publica that he longed for was never going to come back because it didn't exist in his own days, and they were the best days of his times.
I think we're gonna round it up there. I hope you enjoyed this two-part of the Yule recording Dynasty, which you can now listen to back to back, and I highly recommend you do. Also check out the episode we did on Germanicus, whom on the date of recording, which is 10th October, is actually the anniversary of his death, the day he died. And of course, we made an episode on Agrippa, I'm sorry if I say that wrong, and which was also 1 year old, not a few weeks ago, which is, again, crazy to think about. But of course, before you go, do you have anything you want to promote? Where can people find you on social media if they have any further questions about any topic that we discussed these past 2 weeks? And where can people buy your books if they are interested in learning more about some of other Julio-Claudian history?
Thank you. Well, it's been a pleasure. It really has been. I always enjoy our conversations because you just we go where the conversation goes, and it's very wide ranging. We bring lots of subjects up. I'm active on X, formerly known as Twitter, where you can find me as at Lindsay_Powell.
I don't know if my X is there, but we'll see.
I post things every day, things which are newsworthy, things which relate to my research, anniversaries, and that type of thing. So follow me on there. If you're on Facebook, just look for Lindsay Powell Author. You'll find me and my postings there. And I have a website, which is lindsay_powell.com. Don't use that so much, so I tend to be an active user of social media. My books, look, just for Lindsay Powell. You'll find them in all the major book websites, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Chapters, Waterstones in the UK, and many more, indeed. And my books are available not only as hardbacks, but paperbacks and digital books.
Thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to talk to you again, and you're always welcome back on the podcast. This has been Without Aged Well. We are available on Instagram, Without Aged Well, Twitter, I'm still gonna call it Twitter, and Without Aged Well with one L, because I must not know to use two. Unfortunately, the name was too long. But we are also available. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you can find podcasts. Please write a review on Apple or iTunes if you have an iPhone or listen there. I know there are quite a few of you. I read up a review last week, and I would love to do more of those. If I get more reviews in, that would be lovely. And if you're on Spotify, give us 5 stars. That would help a lot. Please like, share, and subscribe. My name is Alan, and I'll see you next time.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.